You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Matt Alagaya. On today's show...
I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
The world reacts to Donald Trump's decision. My guests Somnath Batabyal and Brian Klass will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the historic visit of Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan to Greece and what it means for relations between the two NATO allies. Who is really behind the purchase of a $450 million painting, and why does it matter? And how well do you know the state of your own country? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Matt Alagaya. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Batabyal, who is a lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS, and Brian Klass, a fellow in comparative politics in the Department of Government at the London School of Economics. Welcome back, both of you, to Midori House. We start today's programme with the aftermath of Donald Trump's decision to recognise Jerusalem as Israel's capital. There have been clashes today across the West Bank as Palestinians' anger spilled out onto the streets, and dozens of countries have voiced their opposition to the decision. Saudi Arabia, for instance, said it was irresponsible and unjustified. France said it rejected the decision, and the UK has called it unhelpful. Somnath, let me start with you. Now, the UN Security Council is meeting tomorrow for an emergency session on this issue. Any change likely to come out of that, do you think?
I doubt, because somehow the UN Security Council always bows to US pressure. US extends its pressure in all the UN bodies, especially the Security Council. So perhaps not, but 8 of the 15 countries have called for the meeting. So it shows the seriousness of the situation. Nations across, as you said, have strongly condemned or are very wary of what's going on. One of the things to look out for here is we have to remember that the Second Intifada started when Sharon went to Jerusalem to Temple Mount, and immediately it started with a riot. As you say, news of riots are coming in today. The U.S. Embassy has warned its officials in Tel Aviv not to go to the West Bank. The families are barred from going to the West Bank. So there is a feeling of insecurity, of something might go wrong, which is already in the air. It is in this light that the Security Council meets, because in a small flare-up will result in things going out of control very quickly.
And do you suspect that might happen? What do you think are the chances that we might see more unrest than we've already seen today?
Look, no one knew that a visit by an Israeli prime minister in Jerusalem to Temple Mount would result in the Second Intifada. And that was perhaps in the larger scheme of things, slightly less significant than America's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital. So, but that really spiraled out of control. I hope it doesn't, but it's something which is not going to be controlled very easily. There'll be sporadic sense of violence. We've called for 3 days of unrest. The Palestinian Authority has already called for it. So that, you know, and this is, it's so unpredictable, the reactions that might happen, that one can't foresee. But the fact that there's an official statement from the U.S. Embassy to its members in Israel to avoid certain areas shows that there's always a chance and a risk.
Brian, what do you think? Do you think the UN Security Council meeting tomorrow will have any effect? I mean, what are you expecting from that?
I don't think it will really change things on the ground, but I think it's significant in the sense that the U.S. president is so out of step with his Western allies that there is actually the call to have an emergency meeting reaction to U.S. action, right? So this is something where there's a broader picture here of how Donald Trump makes foreign policy. It's not in consultation with allies. It's adding to problems where there is already a huge amount of political risk and international security risks in the world that are already on Trump's plate. He's also facing an investigation back home and you know, terrible approval ratings, et cetera. And also, he makes foreign policy as a way to sort of toss red meat to his political base in domestic politics. And this is exactly what's happening right now. This is not done for any reason other than to rile up people who already like Donald Trump in America. And so I think that, you know, this is the bigger story that may be missed here, is that obviously this is hugely consequential for the Middle East. It's hugely consequential for Israel and the Palestinians. But it's also a long-term trend that Trump is making foreign policy for all the wrong reasons and without consultation of long-standing alliances. And I think that is where the long-term trajectory of this story, I think, is going to go is not going to be different in the coming years. And more volatility is going to be likely because of Trump's impulsive behavior.
And so do you think there is a kind of, I guess, this administration having a Middle East policy? Can you see that emerging at all? Or is this very much just playing to the gallery up back
home? It's just playing to the gallery. Trump has no clue about Middle East politics. He put his son-in-law, who has no clue about Middle East politics, in charge of brokering a peace deal. The peace deal is not going anywhere. And even if it were, it would now be dead because it is, I mean, it's long been a myth that the U.S. could be an honest broker in this conflict. But this absolutely decimates any possibility of someone believing that, right? I mean, it's so obviously not part of good faith for being an independent broker. Now, whether you agree with the decision or not, I'm just saying that it's going to affect the prospects for the U.S. being involved in future peace negotiations. And, you know, I mean, it's just like when you take a step back, he put a 36-year-old unqualified real estate developer with no background in the conflict who happened to be a relative of his in charge of this. So it's not a terrible surprise that this is not exactly going towards peace and actually is on the brink of conflict now.
Samnath, what would you say the effect is going to be on the peace process? I mean, we've already heard the Palestinians come out fairly strongly against this, but yeah, what do you think the effect will be in future?
Well, as Brian correctly points out, it's a kick in the teeth for every Palestinian. So any chance? I mean, there's hardly anyone involved in Middle Eastern politics who would think of, as you say, the U.S. as an honest broker, but there was this conversation which was kept under wraps. With this, you know, Donald Trump has just basically unveiled the fact that the U.S. really doesn't give a damn about Palestine or the two-state theory or the possibility of a two-state negotiation. So that's over. Again, Brian points out about how he's playing to his home base in the U.S., but it's also that he's bowing to pressure from his finances. He had enormous amount of money coming in for his campaign from particular quarters who put pressure on him to do this. Even when the last time he waived the 6 months rule which they have about the embassy in Jerusalem, the last time he did it, he came under a lot of pressure from the Zionist lobby in the U.S. to not to do this. And to come back to your original question, things look bleak. And U.S. will not, in the near future, will not be able to play any part in whatever deal comes out between Palestine and Israel.
And Brian, I mean, were you surprised by this? I guess it's interesting. There was quite a lot of surprise yesterday. But after all, this was, you know, it was one of Trump's campaign pledges. And it has been campaign pledge for many U.S. presidential candidates before him. Yeah. Were you surprised at all?
I was surprised at the timing and the decision to do it now, because you're absolutely right. I mean, this has been the U.S. Senate passed a resolution in the mid-90s, you know, almost unanimously calling for the embassy to move and to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Most presidential candidates pledge this. So it's not a terrible departure from sort of the rhetoric. But doing it now at a time where there's already immense volatility in the Middle East, I mean, you still have the Syria conflict, you have Yemen, you have this grand power rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia, not to mention all of the other perils with the Iran nuclear deal, and then further afield, the North Korea nuclear crisis, there's a lot to deal with. And so I think that's where I highlighted that point, that this domestic political calculation creating an inflammatory foreign policy crisis at a moment where there are already so many balls up in the air that are being juggled by the U.S. administration is just, it shows the recklessness, the lack of consultation, the lack of foresight and strategic thinking at a time when that is in absolute short supply in the White House and we need it more than ever. So I think, you know, there are serious risks ahead, but more to the point, and this has always been the problem with Donald Trump, it's a person who knows very little about the world with a lot of influence over it. And that is ultimately the peril that we find ourselves in for the next several years, probably.
And but, Benjamin, sorry, please, go.
The thing, it was interesting to see how he made it, how he framed his speech about, he fancies himself as a deal maker, as a, you know, breaking from the past, from things which have not worked for the past many decades. I mean, the danger in this is that somebody who wants to break from the past also needs to have a great knowledge about the past. The problem with Trump, as Bryony pointed out, that he has hardly any knowledge about the Middle East. So his breaks are dangerous.
And Brian, Benjamin Netanyahu has said that others are going to come forward, that he's had discussions with other nations. Are there any signs of any other nations coming forward to recognize Jerusalem as the capital?
I haven't seen any, but I think that, you know, there's obviously... this is obviously an issue in which the U.S. has long been out of step with global opinion. That doesn't make it necessarily wrong in any sort of sense, but it is one where I think there's more peril about the lack of consultation, as I said before. I don't see this as a tipping point in any sort of way. I could be completely wrong about that, but I think that the symbolism of it for Trump was very important, and for Israel also very important. For the rest of the world, a moment where they're seeing flashing red signs of volatility in international security problems.
And finally, Somnath, what's the, I guess, response that we can look out for from Arab nations? I mean, it's worried them. The Arab League is due to meet on Saturday to discuss this matter. What will they be looking at in particular, do you think?
Oh, they're very worried. I mean, U.S.'s closest ally, Saudi Arabia, has come out condemning it. The Turkish president has said that there's a red line which has been crossed. So there'll be universal condemnation about it. But again, the problem is Trump does not follow any diplomatic protocol. He doesn't really give a damn. He just does what he feels like. I'm sure several in the White House are wringing their hands and heads at what he has done. So he doesn't care about what the global opinion is or what foreign governments think. He doesn't give a damn about his own aides. So yeah, it's something which the world has to learn to deal with, this unpredictability.
Okay, let's move on now and let's head to Greece, where Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has landed today to kickstart a historic visit. It's the first time a Turkish head of state has visited the nation in over 65 years. Brian, just explain what this meeting is for, ostensibly, and also what it means, I guess, more symbolically for relations between these two powers.
Well, it's obviously a major step because of how novel it is and how historically, how historically different it is from the past relationship, and it's trying to normalize relations. But I think the aspects here that are some of the bigger picture things we need to keep in mind is that you have two NATO members who are meeting together and having to reckon with the fact that NATO is now including one person one state that is effectively nearing dictatorship, right? And that Erdogan is grappling with these issues that have come from his consolidation of power domestically. So one of the things that he's dealing with in Greece is this attempt to try to basically extradite people who were supposedly involved in the failed 2016 coup plot last summer. Now, this is something where Erdogan is seeing a lot of the world in the same way through a domestic lens. So it's creating problems across the world. In the same vein, you have this coming in U.S. politics, where Erdogan has one of his henchmen on trial in New York for international money laundering, and then also Michael Flynn, Trump's ex-national security advisor, allegedly involved in a plot to kidnap Gulen, one of Erdogan's enemies who lives in Pennsylvania. So I think that when you look at Erdogan and his international relations, you have to think about it through this lens of consolidation of power domestically. And it's where dealing with him becomes increasingly difficult on any sort of normal strategy, because his prevailing goal is to create a Turkish state in which he is the sole power, and he's doing a very good job at doing that. And unfortunately, that's the fundamental question NATO has never confronted: is what do we do with a member that's supposed to be a democratic alliance when they become a dictatorship? And that's going to be the question, I think, for 2018.
Somnath, what do you think will be top of the agenda in Athens? We've already heard that he's trying to extradite some people involved in the coup. Is there anything else that will be kind of a central topic here?
Oh yeah, the agency and talks about territorial water. One of the sore points has been the kind of territorial dispute, airspace. As recently as 2016, a Greek prime minister on his way to Iran was not allowed to land near Anatolia to refuel because apparently it was a demilitarized zone. So, Brian points out that the eight Turkish dissidents who were there, AGNC, but the problem also is that it's a long history. The acrimony between the two countries goes back since 1832, four wars have been fought. there's a brief period of 1930s, 1940s, where there's peace, then the earthquake diplomacy, which happened in the early 2000. But this two communities have really been at loggerheads. So suddenly, a president and a prime minister deciding that the past is over and we'll take a giant leap forward, it won't be this easy to say that this, you know. I mean, there's a huge amount of mistrust. And I say this from coming from a country where I have seen communities really divided, like, say, India and Pakistan. It's very difficult to, because of this long history of mistrust, to suddenly come together. So the rhetoric of forget the past, we start anew, is a difficult one. And I find it dubious.
And Brian, the refugee crisis will presumably also feature because these two countries are so intimately linked when it comes to the refugee crisis and people coming across the Aegean Sea. What do you think they'll be looking to talk about? And is that a potential area of conflict, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they're looking for some way to deal with the problem in a mutually agreed way. But, you know, this is the problem with diplomacy with such contentious issues. Yeah. There's not a huge amount of overlap. I mean, so I think with a lot of these diplomatic visits, whether it's Turkey and Greece or Trump in Asia or whoever it is, the goal for the leaders is not just to try to solve a problem. It's also to look, you know, presidential or statesmanlike on the global stage and to try to say, I am doing what I'm supposed to do on behalf of the people. So, you know, what I would expect from this visit is both sides trying to come away and claim victories without any real meaningful agreement on policy change.
And, what would a victory look like for each one of these sides, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's for Erdogan, he's going to try to say that he's made progress probably on the, you know, territorial disputes and also on extradition. I think the Greeks are probably going to downplay those issues because they're obviously not winning. I mean, it's not a hugely consequential issue for the Greek public whether or not these people are extradited, but then they'll try to talk about victories with refugees. So, you know, I think it's about highlighting the things that they come away from the meeting on. And this is where there's a lot of these symbolic visits that end up producing very little. And yet it's sort of playing to the gallery. And I think that being said, it is still important that there is this visit, right? I mean, it's a break from the past. There's a chance to try to improve this historical memory in a way that is productive. But I do think that at the end of the day, there is a real reckoning that NATO members need to have about Erdogan, because he's just the way that he runs the country is completely out of step with the values that NATO is supposed to stand for. And there's no mechanism really that's ever been used to purge a NATO member, but it's going to come up every single time there's an interaction with Turkey from now on, because it's just there are shared values among almost all the other NATO members, and then there's this one. And Turkey as a linchpin for security has been able to paper over it, but that's only going to last for so long.
I was going to say, I mean, it's presumably its position in the world, apart from anything else, that has meant that it hasn't been ostracized and distanced from the rest of Europe and from the rest of NATO, just because of where it sits in the world.
Yeah, you know, one of the things which bothers me about this conversation is how quickly that Erdogan is saying that, yes, the Greek prime minister has agreed to extradite the 8 soldiers, while the Greek courts have said no. I mean, will due legal process not be followed here again? You know, because of his heft, because of the way he has come in, I'm worried that the legal process might be bypassed. And if the Greek prime minister has actually agreed to this, then he will have to explain to his electorate why and how.
And Brian, finally, how do you deal, do you think, with a leader like Erdogan? I mean, you know, you're talking about NATO needing to face up to him, but also the EU needs to, and his relations with particularly with Germany aren't great. Is there any hope for a rehabilitation, and how might that happen?
Well, I think Erdogan has been able to take for granted, and I think rightly, that there will be no real consequences to his actions, right? So I think that you don't want to go so extreme to say that the West should just break ties with Turkey. It would be bad for everyone, because you need to have some sort of engagement with this hugely consequential player in a hugely consequential region. But at the same time, you know, I mean, the things that you don't do are when Erdogan rigs a referendum to consolidate power and dismantle democracy in Turkey, as he did earlier this year. If you're the president of the United States, you shouldn't call them and congratulate that person immediately.
Yeah.
You know, so there's signaling that can be done where it says, look, we understand that you have your own sovereign territory. We're not going to try to overthrow you or anything like that, but we do not want to extend warm relations to you while you're doing these things that are absolutely anti-democratic and are creating counterproductive outcomes in the Middle East. And this is where, I mean, there's always these tensions, right, with Turkey, because, for example, the Kurdish issue is so close to Erdogan and something he cares about so much, whereas the Kurdish soldiers in Syria and Iraq are really effective for the goals of the United States, for example. So there's always this tension, and that's where I think there is a reckoning that's coming, that you can only paper over these things for so long. And that's why I think hard conversations sooner rather than later will be more productive in the long run.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Matt Alagaya, Somnath Batabyal and Brian Klass. Last month, we spoke about a painting by Leonardo da Vinci, which fetched a record $450 million at auction in New York. It has now been confirmed that the piece is on its way to the newly opened Louvre Museum in Abu Dhabi. But there's a twist to this story. It seems that the mystery buyer is, in fact, Prince Badr bin Abdullah bin Mohammed bin Farhan Al Saud, from a remote branch of the Saudi royal family. And it all came at a time when several members of the royal family are under pressure from a crackdown against corruption and self-enrichment. Brian, do we have any idea where Prince Badr got his money?
I have a pretty good guess. I would imagine it's from oil tied to the Saudi regime. Now, the thing that's remarkable about this story is that this is not a particularly wealthy prince. He's not known for being like some, you know, kingpin in the royal family. He's just this distant relative. And yet he's able to toss $450 million at a single painting. And this comes at exactly the moment that the alleged reform campaign and anti-corruption crackdown is happening. And, you know, what I've said about this story the whole long, there are these people who want to buy into the narrative of Saudi reform, this new page, because they've done this one token thing that makes them seem like they're cutting edge and entering the 21st century. The Saudi regime exists to enrich the royal family. Anti-corruption in a regime that exists to enrich a single family is a joke. And so this exposes this. It's a selective purge, right? So it's a way for MBS to consolidate power in his new Saudi Arabia and to try to send a clear message to anyone who will stand up to him that I'm the one who runs this and don't cross me. And everybody else who gets in line can keep buying paintings for $500 million. And so I think the hypocrisy is just astounding. And anyone who writes about Saudi Arabia in glowing terms for their anti-corruption reform, this story just makes them look like an absolute joke.
Somnath, when you look at Saudi Arabia at the moment and you look at the reforms that MBS Mohammed bin Salman has been putting in place, or rather not, do you have any hope for the future?
You know, when I looked at this story, just before I come to your question, sums get thrown around, bandied around so much that you don't really think about it. 450 million. I just thought, what can it do? As somebody who was trying to buy a house in London recently, it could be 450 houses in zone one and two of 3 and 4 bedrooms or more. I mean, this is the kind of money he throws at a painting. It's just unimaginable, the sums. And therefore, the question comes why the 99% gets disaffected and angry, and the reason the Saudi king at this point of time, that possibly two reasons of his supposed anti-corruption drive. One is to bring the dissident members of his family in line, not let the corruption spread far and wide, but keep it controlled in a smaller family circles. The other is to show some kind of, to have a certain representation to the disaffected youth of Saudi Arabia, those who don't have jobs, that this royal lifestyle cannot continue in the age of social media, when things are flashed quickly, when media, international media picks up on this, that there is certain kind of anti-corruption movement. But as Brian again says, it is a joke. This story exposes it. It's a kick again. I use that phrase again, a kick in the teeth for the general population.
And Brian, let's look at the museum now. I mean, the Abu Dhabi Louvre has been in the news a lot recently. It opened after 10 years, I think, of sort of people waiting for it. Does that discredit the newly opened museum in any way, do you think? The fact that this painting has come from Prince Badr?
I mean, all of the money in a lot of these regimes comes from people who are elites taking money from the population. If you go down that road, it's like saying that, you know, Abu Dhabi is discredited, Dubai is discredited. I mean, it's all money that has been skimmed off what would be an otherwise much richer population. So, Yeah, I mean, you can make that argument, but it's a very quick slippery slope because the regime exists to enrich a very narrow number of people. This is the truth in all oil-rich Arab regimes and many oil-rich non-Arab regimes. And so, you know, it's one of these things where what I would hope from this story is that people in the West stop getting duped by the token reforms and start thinking critically about how this is actually what the system is set up to do. And secondly, that it exposes to the people who put all their trust in this new reformer that, look, if you're serious about this, you cannot continue in this path, right? You cannot just continue saying that you're going to crack down on corruption and then have these massive, you know, sums thrown around without a second thought. And that's where the long-term prospects for reform must come, is that the people have to eventually say enough, right? And that's when it becomes politically untenable, because right now, it's not. They're able to maintain a position of authority. The Saudi royal family is still reasonably secure, and in fact, the international community is helping it by writing. You know, there's a series of puff pieces that have been written in the last couple months about, you know, the new Saudi Arabia, and there was a great thread on Twitter that I saw that. I can't remember who posted exactly, but it went through the New York Times from 1950 with search for the words reform in Saudi Arabia. And it had like 100 different articles written about the new era, the new prince. And it just over and over, it's just history repeating itself because we want to believe it. But it's, you know, it's a monarchy that'll exist to enrich the family in the 21st century.
Right. Can I come in on that point of museums and whether the museum in Abu Dhabi will be discredited. Sorry to kind of mention this, but most museums across the world, especially in the West, are discredited places.
Right.
Of 400 years of colonialism, looting from colonized places. So the general population has always been brutalized when it comes to museums. England is a prime example.
Now, we must move on, but that is a very good point there. A new survey from Ipsos Mori called The Perils of Perception has revealed that the public in over 30 nations have deeply inaccurate views about crime, terrorism and other issues. Somnath, you study the media
yes.
for your job. Why do you think people get it so wrong, do you think? I mean, people have got the murder rate wrong. They think it's gone up, but it's actually gone down. Deaths from terrorism, they think, have gone up, and in fact, they've gone down. Why do people get it so wrong?
Well, I mean, just basic media theories. Most people in the modern world get their idea of the world from news, general news, newspapers, now fake news, whatever it be. Now, all kind of reporting is a representation. You know, there's no actual lights being represented. It's a representation done by somebody for a particular audience. You know, and there could be 100 reasons behind it, but it's not reality. It's a representation. So therefore, and I'll give you an old story as an example. In the 1980s, two very young, smart reporters joined two newspapers in New York, the crime reporters. Within few months, they managed to actually have this crime wave going in both newspapers. But in those months, when you saw official statistics, crime rates had actually come down in the city. So it depends on, you know, who is doing it for what purpose. Everyone believes crime goes up because crime sells. So newspapers have crime reporters. You do not have peace reporters. Or, you know, so it depends on what the beats are, what kind of stories audiences want, what kind of focus groups create those ones, those stories. You know, terrorism, most people believe that more people die in terror attacks in America, but it's not true. It's more about gun control. So this kind of perceptions exist everywhere. And news, which makes sense of our reality, is a prime vehicle of it.
Brian, is this just a media story, do you think, or is there a kind of nostalgia that comes in collectively into a society, do you
think? There's definitely a nostalgia for this sort of mythological past of everything being better.
Yeah.
But there's also political elites and politicians who are using this, right? So I think about Donald Trump's extremely dark acceptance speech for the Republican National Convention last year, where he was saying, I alone can fix it, and he basically painted America as this dystopia. And violent crime was like the lowest it had been in decades, and yet he was said it was way, way up, right? So it's partly the political, you know, exploitation of these stories. But it's also, you know, it's harder to write a compelling story about the good news that's just the steady trend.
Yeah.
So, like, I think there's a lot of terrible stories that have come out this year that have been very depressing. And as an American, I've been very depressed at the direction of the country. But if you look globally at something like child mortality, right, infant mortality or deaths in childbirth, it is shocking. I mean, just from 1950 to now, it is such an improvement, a dramatic improvement. And yet, it's hard to write that story. I mean, what are you going to say that, like, a child was born today and they didn't die? You know, so whereas when bad things happen, it's much more of an aberration. It's easier to get news. It's easier to get coverage, and people click on it. So it's partly our own fault, too, because we like to consume news that says the world is falling apart.
Okay, guys, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That brings us to the end of today's show. Somnath Batabial and Brian Klass, thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show is produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Del Anna. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. I'm Matt Alagaya. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.